Professional Responsibility Committee will come to order. And the first one on our agenda is Senate Bill 36, which amends the Oregon Constitution upon voter approval at the next regular general election to require that deliberations of each House, its committees, and committees of whole be open. I don't know if there's any great argument about this bill. It's the kind of practices that the Oregon legislature has always observed. And I don't know whether we have anyone to testify for this bill or not. It is a bill submitted by this committee. The sponsor who did submit this is not here yet, but we're open to hear any testimony. If there's anyone to testify for this bill, and I don't have the sign-up sheet. Is anyone here to testify on Senate Bill or Senate Joint Resolution 36? Yes. Senator Hurd.
In one of the newspapers, one of the reporters did some research on SJR 36, and far as they were able to determine, the Oregon legislature was only in a closed session once, at least in the last 40 years, and that was kind of in 1936 to 1937.
You know, I would feel that this is a bill that really isn't in question. And that we have always been a group that has taken great pride in the fact that the Oregon legislature is open, that any citizen in the state of Oregon could come here and testify merely by signing up. There's never been any great selection of people, and that we have perhaps the most outstanding legislature in the nation on this. And so I would entertain a motion that we would put this out because it's our practice. I don't think there's any argument about it.
Mr. Chairman, I have a note here that says it may conflict with SJR, HJR 8, and SJR 15. I have no idea what they are.
How would they conflict?
Both of those are the unicameral.
Oh, unicameral? Well, that could be the least of our problems.
I don't think it's
all right.
Mr. Chairman, when I saw that same news, I would said that there didn't seek a session in 1940. I believe that it was an error. In 1963, the House Committee on Taxation met in executive session to hear from the lobbyists for Safeway Stores detail about cigarette revenues, considering the cigarette tax bill. Cigarette revenues by store from the Safeway chain. The press was present, but the public was excluded on the basis that this was information of a trade nature which Safeway was not obliged to give in any respect to which they gave as a matter of interest about their border stores. There might be a room for that type of...
Well, sit right there, no, I'm going.
Yeah,
you're not going to get off that easy.
I kind of wish you'd come. I kind of wish you hadn't come until your bill was up.
No. Corny, do you really feel that this was that secret information as to their volume of sales?
Safeway would not give us the information except under such an executive session. In an executive session, the lobbyists involved were third parties.
Mm-hmm.
He told us the information was there, but he said that for competitive reasons they were not going to disclose the sale, particularly their Hayden Island.
But would not these facts been available if we had the legislature been willing to dig or pursue?
I don't know how they would have been, since it wasn't necessary. We didn't
find out. But I meant that we would have had the privilege of subpoenaing to, say, Liggett Myers or somebody else, that they could have given us the same information by, if we had desired to do this.
Could they have kept it secret, or would it then have been public to the world?
Well, it could have been public to the world, but I mean, if we wanted that information, would it not have been available by subpoena? That this was maybe as an extended out of courtesy or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can believe this, but Representative Pollock. These could have been available. These were done. If we wanted that particular information, perhaps we would have gotten it by conversation anyway. If this was our idea that we should not do it, but the fact that we have open meetings.
I'm not arguing against it.
Well, I know, I'm not either. I'm just trying to say.
The time when that reporter did not report it, that led to the 40 years.
Yeah. Are there other questions? Who's the other lawyer over here? Would you like to?
Well, I didn't set a place for me at the table, Mr. Chairman. Because I said I wasn't going to be here, and I got back early. I'm leaving.
Well, why don't you sit over there in the good senator from Eugene's seat?
May show up and I don't
well, I don't know. But when he comes, then you can leave. You know?
Well, he might take that personally.
We're not accustomed to having a Senate member over the side. Is that what it is? Or would you like to make a statement?
I thought maybe you
all right.
The person left. are ways of handling it.
They will trade issues.
No, you go right ahead.
Well,
I am entertaining your motion.
Yes, thank you.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lloyd Jensen, and I'm here representing the Oregon AFL-CIO. And we'd like to go on record as favoring this bill. It looks like a common sense piece of legislation. And I myself have never heard of too many problems come up of where it has been secretive as far as the legislature is concerned. And I see there's a little cleanup in the language where it says the doors, and it has been deleted. Is the deliberations of each house, of its committees, and the committees as a whole shall be open. I see nothing wrong with that. I don't think that you discuss personalities in these meetings and negotiations where somebody's past record or their qualifications are discussed. So being voted in office by the people, I think that most of what you talk about is their business, with the exception of very few cases. So I think we have a very clean legislature, and I see no problem as to why the bill was drafted and presented to your committee to draw up, but on behalf of the Joint Council of Teamsters, LB Day asked me to comment that themselves and the AFL-CIO would like to favor a due pass on this bill.
Thank you, Lloyd. Are there questions of Mr. Commissioner?
One comment, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
2004 passes, we may be doing salary negotiations very soon.
Okay, so then maybe we have to do them in the public. I would feel, you know, if I may now be allowed an editorial comment, that we also do salary negotiations with the state of Oregon, which, and if teachers go into the same thing by 2004, regardless of the opposition that talks against 2004, I don't think it's going to make much difference. It will be done much in the same manner that we are negotiating with the state. And inevitably, as the state moves into financing schools, this will eventually happen, and that we're able to handle this. And it's going to be kind of, I feel, a rude surprise to the legislature that they're no longer going to be able to say what wages are not going to be paid. It's going to be handled by a negotiation team. And the idea or the day that we could sit down here and say, well, we don't care what you do, we're going home, we're going to pay you $1.50 an hour, is over. And you're going to have to take whatever the negotiation teams of the state of Oregon settle on. Otherwise, you're going to be faced with state walkouts. And I don't think this is even a question anymore.
I thought there was a no-strike provision.
That's an editorial comment. For 2004, and I will, you may take it for what you like. Go ahead. Do you have some rebuttal?
I have a question. Of its committees, that would include subcommittees, too, I presume.
On salary negotiations?
No.
Oh,
on
this.
I'm speaking the bill.
Oh,
I'm
not okay.
Editorializing on
it. I agree with you.
Before.
Is there a further comment on this bill?
I mean, there's no question of what's included there.
No, I don't think so. I think we're talking about the whole legislative process, too.
What about when the President of the Senate calls a committee meeting in his office of committee heads?
Not necessarily whether that is a... I don't understand whether that would be considered business of the legislature or whether that would be business of where you're asking for advice.
I've seen the speaker do it, and I've seen the president do it, and I just wonder what would happen if a reporter or somebody from the other party walked in.
Well, I really don't know, but I think this is a question for the courts, but I think that our intent is that all meetings that are official public meetings will be open. And I'm not sure whether that would yet be considered an official public meeting. I mean, it would be determined whether this was an official committee meeting or an official meeting of the House or Senate.
I move we vote on Wally's question.
All right, the question has been asked for. All those in favor of Senator Carson's motion that we send Senate Joint Resolution 36 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass. And before I ask for everybody, I'm going to take a consensus first, because only the Senate can do this, We have three House members. Are there anyone here now who is opposed to it? All right, then will the clerk call the roll of the Senate? Those in favor will answer aye. Those opposed, no.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Gray?
Aye.
Senator Hyten?
Aye.
Senator Richard?
Aye. Seeing as the senator from Lane County was the one who proposed it, if there is no objection. I don't know though, wait just a minute. Wally, would you like to carry this bill?
I'd like to see Senator Hartson carry a bill out of this committee that he was in favor of.
Well, now there's a big idea.
Do I have to vote for it?
Well, you don't have anything objective. All right, let's give it to Senator Hartson. Well, no, let's give it. No, I think that's all right. He's got other things that he's going to be wanting to carry. We'll sign this then to Senator Hartson.
The pornography
bill. Yeah, we'll give him the pornography bill. All right, we'll turn to Senate Bill 578. All right, Senate Bill 578 requires a certain election campaign financial statement to include profession, occupation, or business affiliation of contributors, as well as name and address of such contributors. Sponsored by the Committee on Elections at the request of Secretary of State and the Oregon AFL-CIO. And we have both of these here in Jack Tops, and you're here tonight. And I think you signed up first to testify. Jack Thompson, Secretary of State's Office, Department of Elections.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jack Thompson, Assistant Secretary of State and Supervisor of Elections for the State of Oregon, speaking here this evening on behalf or in support of Senate Bill 578. This is a pretty straightaway type thing, and it doesn't have any, you know, little hookers in it or anything.
That's in the pornography, though.
I'm sorry. Yes, <it's better. laughs>
Oh,
anyhow, the purpose of this bill is twofold, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. One is to bring into conformity, and there is a package, and I don't really know why this bill ended up in this committee. It's a pure elections bill. But there are two purposes behind this bill. One is to bring Oregon reporting on finance, campaign finance regulations more into conformity with a federal law, which does require this type of information. Part of it, rest of the package is the filing date, particularly the pre-election filing date, which is another bill. And secondly, to make more meaningful to the public the contents of the summary reports issued by the Office of Secretary of State on contributions and expenditures. Okay, I've been around a little while, and I can run down through a list of contributors and pretty well figure out who they represent, but the average person cannot. And I think that the profession, occupation, business affiliation of a contributor is a significant addition to the name and address of the contributor. Basically, that's all the bill requires, a request, and certainly I think it makes our Chapter 260 more meaningful and significant in the eyes of the people who use these.
All right, are there questions of Jack or Mr.
Jack, don't explain that. The address necessary.
For the hate mail and the...
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ingalls, the address, from my point of view, is necessary for audit purposes. During my experience in auditing C&E reports, I found that there have been some fictitious addresses. It's important to know about Baltimore, you know. It's important to know about Los Angeles. It's important to know about the Minnesota and places of that sort. It's also important, I think, to candidates and political parties to know the address. The C&E report is a valuable document as far as political parties and candidates are concerned. A good list to get a hold of. As you know, we do not publish the address, nor would we publish the profession, occupation, or business affiliation summary report. If someone is interested enough to come to our office and get that information, it's open to public inspection as any public record is.
This would not be in this last published book.
No.
Okay. Now, that probably answers your question.
Jack, would this
That's our Kennedy plan.
Prevent someone from using the post office box in another town? Could they do that?
No, sir. The only instance where a person can use a post office box or a business, or you know, a storefront type thing, is if they file with us first. That so-called fictitious address, and it is, well, that's a bad stretch of word, file with us a statement giving the name and the true residence address of the treasurer of the committee. Committees and our candidates can use post office boxes or storefronts if they wish, but as a matter of record, their true address must be on file in our office.
Are you speaking of a group known as the committee from the last session? Our last campaign, some people received contributions from, quote, a committee, end quote.
Oh, a committee. Yes, that was a very clever title of a committee.
You have the actual address.
Yes, the chairman, Representative Ingalls, we do have the real name and address behind that committee on file now. Mm-hmm.
Jack, as a matter of information, do you cross-check when a candidate refers to a Committee for Action for Better Government? Do you cross-check that to make sure that the Committee for Action for Better Government is the true name of the people who did the contributing?
We do.
Now, I had a remark to present you today.
Well,
have you checked out
okay,
the committees?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm a bureaucrat in the pure sense of the word. You give me enough money, enough bodies, and I can do a better job. I think that's a phony statement. But we do operate under certain restraints. Mm-hmm.
I listened to you today about, I mean, you don't have enough money to do the sort
of thing. To do the detailed auditing of these reports that I think are necessarily required. The report that you remonstrated on or against, I don't know the jargon. Anyhow, you had a few
whatever
words
it was
about a report. Okay. That came in labeled complete and final.
Uh-huh.
All right. What are our auditors supposed to do? Take the committee's word for it? Or, you know, it would have been a simple thing to check back. Which wasn't done. The total expenditures were almost, well,
I was a little disturbed because he showed what he, $20,000. Yeah. That's what he spent in the last 10 days, $6,000, and then we have $21,000.
That's getting off in a rather parochial issue, and that's...
Well, not parochial to me, because that's a big issue down home about who spent how much money.
Indeed, and we're not covered by any embarrassment because of that error. The report was filed in that way, and if we had had enough time and money to pour into really checking these out, we would have found that error.
But Dad, you know, you become the official document for the state of Oregon. That will be what everybody uses.
No, that is not the official
document. Oh, I would disagree with you. This would be the sort of thing that any candidate would pick up. Here's the official document. Somebody spent $6,000, they spent $22,000, and I spent $15,000. And then when the argument was that I was buying a campaign, and in reality he was spending more money than I was, that is official as far as anybody down in my community.
Senator Ripper, I've been around since 1959. I know enough not to quarrel with the chairman of the committee, and I don't intend to at this point.
I'm not quarreling about this bill. I'm quarreling about something else right now.
Another time.
How do you feel?
I'm feeling very fine, thank you.
Fine.
Not up to my usual fire, Mr. Chairman. Coming around, though. Mm-hmm. The bill that you have before you, I think, would enhance the quality and the meaningfulness of the contributions and the reports, and I do ask for any favorable consideration. Are there any further questions?
Well, all I want to know is would they be checked out just as well as the other part of it? They're no value unless they're checked out, are they?
Our budget is now being reviewed by Ways and Means, and what they do to that budget determines somewhat on how I, as administrator, allocate the funds that are given to us by the Legislative Assembly to do a job. For instance, on this C&E report, it was the biggest report in the history of the state of Oregon. It was the most costly and the latest. Okay? Three big pluses for me, okay?
No.
And the
Just slow down. I don't want you to get excited. No. I really don't, because I'm not trying
to
do that.
The reason that happened was that I ran out of money. And I said we have to stop hiring extra personnel. I couldn't even hire my own auditors in the audit division. And we put it together on overtime, not overtime, but comp time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fine.
That's the reason for it, Senator. And it is a good report. It's not a report I'm proud of. It's shot full of errors.
I don't want you to get excited. I want you to...
That's what my doctor...
Okay, I know, but I just want you to give me a nice response and don't get way up in the air.
Yeah.
I understand what you're talking about.
And I cut off the auditing simply because we ran out of money.
Okay.
I don't like to run deficits into Ways and Means or sit there with Hansel Newbery at all. Carry my hide off because I'm a poor custodian of the funds given to us to entrust to Minister.
All right.
It's a bad report.
All right, are there questions?
Not much.
Well, he sympathizes quite a little bit. He can understand what the problem is. Are there some further questions to Mr. Thompson?
Thank you, Mr.
Jack, thank you. And I didn't mean to get you up in the air.
Have a date later on. I'll
sit down, sit down.
No, I have to go another meeting.
Okay, fine. For the rest of the benefit of the audience, Jack had a heart attack here very shortly, and I probably shouldn't have got him that excited, and I didn't mean to get him that way, but it's a very close thing to me, and rightly so, I think, because whether he says so or not, that's the official document. When you show that your opponent spent $16,000 or $17,000 less than he did, you have a right to get excited. Mr. Knudsen.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, I think probably the reason this bill was ever drafted and submitted was that a few years ago there was quite an expensive race that had considerable foreign money or outside the United States gambling money, and it did make quite a stir and do quite a bit of changes to a lot of the election laws, and I think probably that's the reason for the name and the address and the profession. And on behalf of the AFL-CIO and COPE, which is the Committee on Political Education, we've complied with this. It's in our bylaws, and our members insist upon it. And we are a labor organization, and we do not hide it, and we fill out all the forms. And I think it's a healthy thing that in the state of Oregon that we do constantly try to update and keep Oregon a good election state, and I think that it is, and I think Jack Thompson does a magnificent job, and we'd like to favor the film.
Are there questions, Mr.
No, I just like to point out to Mr. Knudsen that I don't think the inclusion of the Constitution
or business affiliation
would have shed any more light on the contribution of the young campaign.
Is that whose campaign it was?
Well,
you said
it, I didn't.
No, I said it was a campaign. An election.
We appreciate your efforts
around
here.
Okay, fine. The Attorney General's campaign, that's what I'm speaking about, and it did create the cause for the bill. I don't know that it changed anything. But I agree with you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are, there's a small conflict, and I'm going to have our administrative assistant explain it to us.
Well, the smallest one is on House Bill 2242, which is right now is in the House Committee. It hasn't gone anywhere yet, hasn't had a hearing, but it just changes the language. Says in section would be in section 3 of Senate Bill 578. It just changes the attribution. Instead of saying to any candidate, it says to any one political committee. It changes the language there. It deletes the one there. Let's see. That would be 26140. Oh, I'm sorry. It would be 264142, section 2 of Senate Bill 578. It would be on line 22, page 2. It takes out the word candidate. The only amendment. It does it again on.
That's existing law.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
I don't know either. But they're not anywhere as yet, and not too sure they're going to go anywhere.
Not
that either.
Well, they haven't scheduled a hearing on it. They're not. It's not moving anywhere at the moment. It's the back of their book at the moment.
Do you know
who sponsors it? Blumenauer, Alcoin, Sensmore, Cornell, Kapori, Katz, Kinsey.
Would that have the effect of not making the candidate himself report about the source of his?
Well, it would be the individual who made, if an individual made a contribution to a committee rather than a candidate, you'd have to report anything over $50.
Well, what it's really making, I can't see where it has that much conflict, but what they're really saying is that anyone, a candidate included, who makes any kind of contribution has to file a report.
I went to legislative council with these, and on these two, we've got some on the others we're going to get to in the work session tonight, which are more difficult. But these two, they said, by the time it got back to you on this, by the time we get back to the House side, one of those will have either been tabled or put away, or can catch it up at that time.
Right.
Now, there's another problem, is that in the omnibus bill on elections, which did go to the Senate Elections Committee, which is still not moved, Senate Bill 309, does some major differences, but I talked to Bill Vandiver today, and they have not gotten to the point where they're moving yet either on that bill.
Mr. Chairman, in light of this, I would suggest that the committee approve this bill and ask it to send to the floor and then sent to the Senate Committee on Elections for coordination into there of the bill. And, whichever.
Why
don't we just send this out and let them come along with us?
Well, it seems expensive to the state of Oregon to have two of them trooping one after the other. Why don't they amend this into theirs or the other way around? I don't care.
I was sure that these were going to go anywhere, but I'm not so sure that they're...
309 deletes one of the sections that we're talking about changing in 578 and comes up with some brand new language. There's some serious conflict, but the question is where they're going with it.
I personally think that this really falls into our field about conflicts of interest. And there's one of the best ways to get at conflict of interest, because it's not just saying I have some stock in this or that, but also where your contributors are and who they represent. And I think that this is, I have this feeling that this is a good way to start in on what we're going to be dealing with here before we're finished.
I'm
going to
be hard to nail down. I got contributions from the FLCIL, Teamsters, and AOI.
Well, there's nothing wrong with this, but I think it's right for everybody to know where your contributions, who the people were. But to see an A.B. Smith or a T.B. Weiler or something like that doesn't really mean much to lots of people, including other candidates.
I have no objection to this bill. I think we ought to.
I think that this is well on the direction.
Let's get rid of it out of our budget.
Mr. Chairman, 309, if I can speak up a little bit, I'm on the House Election Committee, and we've got many, many bills to hear. I think that we ought to take the leadership in this committee and send this bill out to the floor to pass.
I think you
can preempt
them. Right, I think that would be legislative council position also. They can just get one out, and then somebody has to take the lead. In addition, Senate Bill 309 increases the amount from $5 to $25, which may, in fact, weigh on what the committee wants to do, too. They would say you can give under $25 and not list name or address or anything else.
All right, let's just, we don't have, we don't have enough over here, but just as a matter right now, is there anybody really opposed to
it?
Because it's a Senate bill, but we have it under a joint committee deal. I think that we have. Let's wait till a couple of them come back. We have some coming back, but if everybody's in accord, we'll wait till they come back and we'll get rid of some of these. But this one, I can see no great. I'm taking a prerogative that maybe is. Tom, do you think that this is all right? I mean, do you have any real hang-ups on this or anything that might bother you a little bit? Yeah, it's the profession that you're adding to it.
The only question I have is whether there's no visible means of support.
Well, he's got retired then. He can write that. I hardly think that's going to be our contributors.
Checking to see if he sent his welfare check.
I do feel that something's got to be done about the... having just gone through a very expensive race, probably the biggest one in the state, and I do feel that something has to be done about it, and I think it's right that people should know who all these contributors are. And we've only begun to see, or I feel that we're just beginning on this. I think something doesn't happen before long. We're all going to be talking like California, $50,000-$60,000 races, and I don't think that's right.
Won't they all come in housewife anyway?
I really don't think that's necessarily true.
Oh dear, have I offended the witness?
I'll let you know when you've offended it.
All right, well, because we don't have it, let's move on to the next one. We'll come back to this then. All right, we have Senate Bill 551. We'll move to that one. And, all right, excludes evidence of child abuse from privileged communications, otherwise supported school personnel and nurses. I think we have some correspondence on this as to make this easier. I don't know whether we have anybody here that's going to testify on this, but
we've already heard it.
We've already heard it.
Yep.
And all we really need now is some legislative council, is it? Did you remember this was because certain teachers felt, or at least advice given to teachers by their own council, was that if you were to give cases of child abuse, that you might be, in a sense, giving up your right to privileged communication. And whether this was right or wrong, and I think we have some evidence here that this might be wrong, but whether it's right or wrong, this is the kind of advice that's being given to teachers. And so if you will go ahead and
okay.
read what we get from legislative council.
I think everybody got a copy of this report, and if not, it should be in the workbooks in front of you, the black notebooks under listed under the title of the bill.
That's correct.
The title of the bill. The black workbook. 551.
That's not it.
551. It'll be in there. There it is.
Okay, 551.
Okay, the question was that the Children's Services Division came over and gave us the amendment and raised the question of, as the chairman said, that the question of not giving testimony under 44040 for certificated staff members in schools and nurses forbade them from making a report of a child abuse. And they said that that was the reason why they only had 12 cases reported. In fact, that would be mixing apples and oranges, according to legislative counsel, because they're mixing reporting with giving evidence in a judicial proceeding. So that by the same token, you could say by the same analogy, a doctor wouldn't be able to report a gunshot wound or report a communicable disease or anything else if you read 44040 that way. So that legislative counsel recommended on the second page of that report you've got in your workbook, if you wanted to take notice of the question raised, it would be to amend the reporting section and not the other one, so that you rewrite the bill as it would be written in your notebook there, to add the second sentence there, third sentence on section one. Nothing contained in ORS 44040 shall affect the duty to report imposed by this section. Next page. Then go down and pick up the original bill as it was printed, and say, use the language as it's given in the printed bill, section one, then becomes section two, and then pick up the question of taking away the privilege for certificated staff members of schools and nurses so that they can testify. So you don't mix testifying and reporting.
If we send this out with this language, then I'll vote against it. Yeah, well, here's the amendment, though. It changes that.
Yeah, I explained it.
Well, with our attorney,
section one is.
You don't have it.
Yeah,
oh, there you go. Oh, yeah, right.
Okay, now what do you want to change? That's the amendment right there.
Yeah.
You have the amendment behind the letter.
Would you, well, let's wait till our attorney has time to read this.
Have you found it, Mama?
I asked my husband about this. That
he inspects all the teachers that come to him in 24 days that they have an
absolute duty and that this would frustrate the present system. So. Hey. Les? It's true that the bill's drafted at 551 is for staff members, which, if you conclude that, it would be more encompassing than the staff members
to
be inclusive anyway hired by the school district
without
the opposed
to. Yeah,
well, I think it was in drafting error there. Because the statute addresses itself to certificate and it's put back in.
Do you like the amendment?
Well, I think that Grattan's right after going to the state council that if we passed this out,
we wouldn't do it.
We'd be in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Is there any objection to this type of amendment? I think that the question has to be answered in the sense that if teachers believe that nothing's happened, and if this will correct what their belief is.
They have bad legal advice.
Well, whatever they got is pretty high, probably pretty high price, though.
But that's the truth, though. It's bad legal advice that they get.
Yeah. Norma.
Yeah.
Is child abuse, is that a legal term? Or
mm-hmm.
Well, then why do we go through in the case of the abuse of a child? Isn't that true? Why not in the case of child abuse? It's defined in 418.740. Or in the child abuse case, it's defined.
Well, you're not changing anything.
I just want to clean up the grammar.
How's it used in 418? Did it say abuse of a child there?
418 is over there. What? seems to me that this is more particular language than what you suggest. In the case of child abuse, it doesn't put it into any particular incident. And this does, if you say in the case of in the abuse of a child, plus that's existing language.
Well, that isn't thanks for thanks.
Well, what is the definition?
Well, it seems to me it points to a particular incident.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, in a child abuse case, that doesn't send you?
You can put it that way, but making after it doesn't say anything.
But I think that you're right, though. You're talking about a specific one now, the abuse of a child, and you're talking about it. Not things in general, but this particular child.
At least it is. At least it is.
It seems to me only a lawyer could have written it.
Obviously, a lawyer didn't write 5 years ago.
Probably a legislator. It's in more than one place to abuse of a child.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. If you change it around, you should change all the letters.
An awful lot of prepositions.
All right. Any consensus, and does everyone agree with this amendment?
Yeah.
Tom?
Right. And there are no conflicts on that to date.
Okay. Then we will
also send it down.
We can, we will send down for Heard in just a minute, and then we'll adopt these. But okay, if there's no conflict here, and I think that this does clear it up, and if it will clear the mind of whoever the counsel is for the OEA, and when they do that, they speak for 25,000 teachers, and this will bring child abuse into a reporting stage, and I'm all for doing this, because I'm sure attorneys could argue about this for hours, but I think the main thing that we're after is to get child abuse reported.
Whatever my Salem attorney tells me to do, I stand up and salute.
You do. Well, I kind of rely on Norman, too. Okay, should we then move over to House Bill 2799?
This is the SHIELD bill. It's something important.
Yeah.
When's that SHIELD bill going to... Oh, no, the open meetings. When are you going to have that on the floor? Anyway?
Thursday, I mean.
Just tomorrow.
No, we don't get it tomorrow.
Oh, is it Thursday?
Thursday. Hurry up and get it.
I guess you're right. Just
whenever we meet after tomorrow, that's my understanding.
Okay.
This is the one that allows psychiatric social workers and mental health division employees a certain amount of privileged communication. We heard last time from Dr. Bray, from Albert Baxter, and from Kathleen Jensen. Kathleen Jensen wanted students covered also. Do we have any other questions on this one? Would you have anything to offer on 2799? Let's listen to Bratton in just a minute for his communications on this bill.
Let me see. We've got a host of conflicts, but I'm just going to come up after I get through to the questions of what the bill is. I went from the last, when we heard the bill, the question was raised on the extension of the language of the printed bill. On lines 25 to 27, page 2, and it was repeated on lines 4 and 5 of page 3, and then used again in paragraphs J and K, or asked any communication made by the patient to him, or his advice given thereon, etc. And the chairman asked me to research this and see what that meant, the impact of that on evidence, extending that privilege in that manner. I talked to legislative counsel. And you have a report similar to the one you got on 551 in your black notebook, also under the same bill, under bill number 2799. And the problem was that unlike the privilege extended to attorneys in B, and this is where they got that language, what is said by the physician to his patient, or the nurse to the patient, or if you were to take paragraph J and K, the social worker or the volunteer to the patient, that would not be privileged. A doctor or nurse or psychiatric social worker could be called and say, okay, and what was your advice to the patient? And that would not be privileged. The doctor or the nurse wouldn't be bound to testify. In fact, I think the committee heard cases related to in the Salem psychiatrist who was called to testify in just those circumstances, and was quite a snafu over that. Legislative counsel pointed this out
They saw no great impact, except for the fact that you would close off the advice of the physician or the nurse to the patient. And the qualification in the last part of that, yeah.
I think it's important for the community to realize that that privilege cannot be exercised by the doctor nor the lawyer. The doctor or lawyer would have to testify unless the patient or the client invokes the privilege.
Right.
The privilege
right.
is to the patient and the client, not to
right.
the doctor and lawyer.
Right. But the thing is that if the patient may not realize this, it may be gotten around by saying it isn't covered in the first place. What you're doing is extending to the patient the right not to have his doctor's
that's
advice
right.
given.
But the objection
yes.
has to be made by the
patient.
Not
that's
by
correct.
The doctor.
That's correct. And the bill would, as it was printed, would continue that. It
mm-hmm.
wouldn't change that. I also talked with, on the advice of Senator Carson, talked with Professor Arthur of Atlanta University Law School. He felt it was a defect
mm-hmm.
in not writing it in that way because you left that gap where stopping an attorney could get through this. And saw no problem with it as long as the modifier in the course of his professional employment was left in. So there's no problem there. And I went over and interviewed at the mental health division Dr. Bray and his chief administrator, Mr. Briggs, on the questions of paragraphs J and K, and talked to them about this. J was pretty straightforward. They felt that that was on its face pretty easy to understand. It was somebody that was easily defined, and it was a certain category to pinpoint that they were trying to extend this privilege to because they have many such psychiatric social workers whose communications with patients in treatment are not privileged. Their snafu, and as they found from the committee the last time, was on employee or volunteer. And I went over to them and asked them to give me some definitions. They are included in the starting of the last paragraph of page 1 of that report and going through. A number of people, they would include under employee physicians not licensed by the state, somebody with a degree from a foreign med school or some other circumstance that can work. They would list a host of other people, physical, recreational, or vocational therapists, practical nurses. Under volunteers, someone not employed, they would include most everybody already covered and students or ex-patients serving as therapy aides. These are drug addicts or cured alcoholics who work in very deeply involved in patient care and treatment that they're attempting to say this privilege should be extended to them too. I raised the question with them and with legislative counsel on the impact of this, and they said, well, it's another extension which includes a larger group. And the question of paragraph J, psychiatric social worker, was not too hard to work with. But on employees and volunteers, there was very little control, very little supervision. And while there is supervision, there is control, but the question is, what power or what authority do you have for sanctions? In the case of an attorney or a physician or anyone else who breaks the confidence, he's going to run up against the ethics of his society, the bar, medical society, etc. But for a volunteer, or someone who is not a member, the only thing you can do is fire him. And that may be a big problem because firing him may not do anything compared to the damage. It would be too late and would not reflect anything compared to the damage done. So that's a hole there. The legislative council said if you wanted to, you could tighten it up. I'm saying, put an amendment in saying, in K, an employee or volunteer functioning in a diagnostic or treatment capacity under the control of and supervised in a mental health program approved by the mental health division, and just narrow it down to those people. It's also narrowed in by saying serving in a diagnostic or treatment capacity. You're not involving the kitchen worker or the gray ladies or anyone else who's there, but simply people involved in and receiving the intimate and confidential confession or statement of a patient.
Sounds pretty good. Let's hear from our lawyer. I know what she's going to say. Not extending privilege.
I agree that we clarify the law as far as what the doctor tells the patient. And I was involved in that patient, and that if he hadn't been willing just to go to jail for contempt, they could have forced him to testify against the patient's wishes, and that would have been very bad. But I'm against extending the village to National Council on Social Work Education people. And certainly to the employees and volunteers.
I asked Dr. Bray if there were anywhere he could point to a problem involving the question of employee or volunteer or psychiatric social worker, and so far he hadn't had any.
They don't take an oath of office either, do they? They have no, they're not sanctioned by the profession or
position. Oh, the psychiatric social worker, I'm not sure. No.
No, Norma, if I am getting this correct from you, and because I presume you're going to speak for most lawyers, you would then say to eliminate K, is that what you're saying?
J and K.
To take
care of the problem about
Would you agree to this then if we eliminated J and K?
Oh yeah.
All right. We'll enter.
In other words, B is all right with you under what is it, 1D?
Well, D and G, it also extends the same thing to nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
it also drops.
Nurses are already a licensed professional nurse is already included, and it just makes it the reverse situation.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Which I believe is probably.
Okay, well, then we'll entertain a motion from you then right now.
Okay, I would move that we delete paragraph J and K. The added language in subsection 2
sure.
on line 31 and 32.
Is there any discussion? Wait a minute. Subsection 2 on line...
Oh, right here.
Oh, down below.
Back
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any further... Any discussion then?
I'm
going to
delete that you'd have to put or back in and delete the comma.
All right. Let's go back to the original language. Would that be better?
Yeah.
All right. Is there any discussion?
In this bill, then, simply we just add the language in 25, 26, and 27, page 2.
Well, also
on page 3 at the top.
Oh, line, I see.
The delete on line 23, page 2, and line 1 and 2, page 3, in a civil action suit or proceeding. It means, in any case.
No, we're really doing this, giving this privilege to the professionals. In simple language, and the non-professionals were deleted.
Okay.
Are there any objections?
Anybody?
All right, then we'll consider that amendment so ordered. I would entertain a motion now.
Wait a minute, time.
Oh, okay, you have some more discussion.
On line 22, page 2, what is a regular physician?
I raised that question and got no satisfactory answer, except that it meant a physician, you could say, a changes to say, I don't know, a license or whatever, but that, it means the same thing.
Is that cut out chiropractors?
I don't know. Connie, what is the regular physician?
I'm not acquainted with the use of the word. They mean MD, they can say that.
Well, it's in the bill. It's in the present law.
All right.
I'll bet that. See,
when the privilege was
first
given,
it was to a regular physician as opposed to a psychiatrist,
and then
in later years, they came in
mm-hmm.
and extended the privilege to psychiatrists and psychologists when they got
to
be a little more respectable, I guess.
Would you like to?
And they just
kind of
that same.
Would
word.
You like this? Well, I don't know whether it should be a licensed physician or whether it should
why
be just a physician or surgeon.
Why not just delete that word? A physician or surgeon.
They're a doctor, are they a physician?
They're not a physician. It's something a little different than the
other.
I'm sorry, there is one section of the Chiropractic Act that refers to the unqualified word physician. The rest of the chiropractic
physician,
but there's one section in there that does not use the
word chiropractic. That's the case, then we better leave regular
in. Maybe better leave regular in there, that's
why
I'm saying.
Okay.
You'd have to go back to the cases then to hear that if they had an origin and that would interpret what regular means. I've never. Mm-hmm. Examine it, but
I'll,
that might very well be to
distinguish
it from the others.
All right, all right. Page, line 28. A public officer, and then we've taken out some of the present
law. Oh, exactly. that's my oversight. This bill was drafted by mental health people, and they checked it with the Attorney General, and he made no changes. They wanted this change simply to tighten that up. I'm sorry I didn't bring it up to the committee's attention before we voted on it.
We haven't voted yet.
The question would be that they felt that they have public officers speaking strictly from their own viewpoint, public officers who have who are not covered anywhere else, who are privy to confidential communications with patients in the mental health division as part of their regular employment, and they felt that it would be nice and tight that way. Legislative counsel made no comment on it. They said, well, that would be up to the committee to see. With either language, one would obviously, their amendment would obviously tighten it up.
What's the public officer?
What's official confidence?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't like that deletion
in
there.
That's all right, if we have extended the others, this deletion is not
necessary. Well, I wouldn't think so.
But then would you like to so move?
I would move that we replace the language on line 29 and 30.
Any objection? If not, so ordered. All right, now we have deleted J and K.
We're going to end up with the original law here.
No, we haven't. We've added J and or D
and G
to take the professionals into this. We have deleted the non-professionals. We have left the public officer as he is now under present law.
Mr. Chairman, I'm...
Can I give one other explanation for the record on this? Justification comes to limit it to those that have a code of ethics.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing to stop the psychiatrist worker from telling Representative Lindquist all the gory details about the business that she doesn't stand to be saying to mind her perspective or lose her certification or anything. So where is the justification that she can blab it all to two of us?
Mm-hmm.
But when you need the information in the court of law, you're precluded from it. Whereas on the other hand, if I did that, I could be disbarred and lose my right to practice.
I agree with you on that. You're not talking to unfertile ground. I've gone through this with her two sessions.
You with your wife?
Is no, with Norman. No, we have sat on committees where we have discussed this very same thing before.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill as amended by this committee, 2799, be reported to the House with a due pass recommendation.
All right, before I'll take a vote, I will ask for consensus from the Senate side. Is there any objection? All right. Then the clerk will read the roll. Those in favor will answer aye. Those opposed will answer no from the House.
Representative Paul?
Aye.
Representative
Lindquist?
Aye.
Representative
Ingram?
Aye. Will you carry this amendment?
Before we get on to the next one, I just wanted to say that there are a number of conflicts with the bill, but none that can't be solved by staff when the time comes.
Okay.
Some of them change language. There's an attempt to put in marriage counselors to the and others, but they can be caught out.
I'd like to move back now to Senate Bill 36, as long as we have a all the Senate here.
That's the item, isn't it?
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
We got 36 and
5. We've already put out 36. We had some people here.
551 and 578.
Okay, 578 then. This is the bill that would require that you would include profession, occupation, and business affiliation on contributions. Now, we did have a consensus on the House side. We did have on the Senate side. We didn't have enough Senate members here to take a vote. And so we're now ready for
the consensus.
As Fred did, the consensus was that the bill would go out as is, which simply stated that on your contribution that you will state not only your name, address, but also your profession or occupation.
Rank and serial number.
Or business affiliation. And if you have a serial number, that too.
All right. We'll now take a vote then. Those in favor will answer aye. Their name called. Those opposed, no. Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
And we'll give this one to one of the senators that is not here, and that will be Senator Carson. Now we'll turn to 551.
51.
We have adopted amendments, if you'll look in your black book, Fred, and that would be under Senate Bill 551, and your second page of, have you got your black book? And these were the amendments that would make, while you weren't here, there was evidence shown that the teachers would not testify or would not give evidence. Legislative counsel said that they felt that they could, but to clear this up, then we were going to go at a different route. So then we would then substitute for the bill the amendments in front of you. Now, those in favor of substituting the amendments for Senate Bill 551, which will deal then with 418.750 and 418.775, which should cover the same evidence or the same problem that we have, will answer aye as their name is called, and those opposed, no. And we were in consensus now before we do this. Okay.
Aye.
Now, those in favor of sending Senator Hurd moves that we send Senate Bill 551 as amended to the floor. Those who are in favor, answer aye. Those opposed, no. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hurd?
Aye.
Senator
Hartman?
Aye.
Senator Hurd, would you like to carry that bill? No, we have
3,002
next. A House bill. And they tell us that this committee doesn't do anything.
You've got a you've got a House Bill 3,000.
We work hard at it, don't we?
3,002, and there should be a brief four-paragraph report on that one too in your black book under the same bill number.
3,002, and this is Mr. Bateson's bill,
right? I talked to Mr. Bateson and with the House Administrative Assistant on the Aging Committee, which has another bill which is in conflict, and have agreed among us, as I understand it, right, that we would take, if the committee wanted to, take section four, on the printed bill and leave that as the bill, striking 1, 2, and 3, and leaving that for the Aging Committee to take care of in House Bill 3005. So if the committee wanted to deal with it, the best way would be to just take 4 and make it make another 1 above it. Just take out what stands above 4. As to the substance of it, legislative counsel recommended, and I've got it in the report, amending it to read, the identity of any person who makes a complaint to the Administrator of the Health Division against any inpatient care facility shall be confidential and shall not be disclosed except as ordered by a court of competent jurisdiction. With the exception of the identity of the person making the complaint, such complaint shall be considered to be a public record. So that you would clear up a number of problems at the same time. One, the fear that the complaint itself would be buried, which and then you know that these complaints would continue to be published in Mr. Bateson's report. Two, the identity of the complainant would remain anonymous, but three, when Mr. Bateson had a problem, when he needed the identity of the person when he was taking action and needed that testimony, you could get a court order in those extreme cases, as I understand it.
And,
right. So that you would... Exactly. So that, and you could then, he could then further assure the complainants that their name would be anonymous, and the only way that it could become out would be through a court order in an action relating to that specific instance, so that an operator couldn't come up and get a court order and get it out just every time there was a complaint. It'd have to be a court of competent jurisdiction to that issue.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
I assume a court of competent jurisdiction would mean the district court in that area. Or a circuit court in that area. Would you have any objections? Or would Dorney have any objections if we made that the appellate court?
I'm not at all sure it wouldn't be the Court of Appeals. Well, I haven't seen those. The only court that would have jurisdiction over the Administrative Procedures Act would be the Court of Appeals to which the appeal is made in a contested case. I don't believe the Circuit Court would have, except in the case of the civil forfeiture bill,
right, where
it is the Circuit Court that makes the adjudication.
Well, I'm thinking that policy changes the Court of Competent Jurisdiction would mean any court that has jurisdiction over that particular case. Courtney is thinking of just his operation and how he has to go through the Administrative Procedures Act. But it could also mean in a civil suit. I could be representing a little
case
lady.
Case of slander, would that come in a civil suit?
Sure, or a little old lady that fell out of bed, and I have to use a report that's come in that two other ladies' relatives have complained that they didn't have bed rails and that sort of thing. So you're not speaking of just this one instance. There are many different ways and many different courts that you could be.
What bothers me is sometimes in the local jurisdiction we get all involved in local. The judge has a second cousin once removed in that damn nursing home too.
Well, now, I
mean,
I
have
the question, because
what's going to keep the Court of Appeals from having that same problem?
Oh, they don't have it.
Well,
they don't have even no better than the circuit judge?
If you put the Court of Appeals in there, you're going to make the law ineffective, because there will be situations where the Court of Appeals won't have jurisdiction of that case, and you'll be making it effective just as far as the ATA is concerned.
Would someone who turned in a false complaint like this, that was simply trying to cause trouble, you know, was mad at somebody, they felt that they charged too much money, would the nursing home then have a right of slander against that individual?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm kind of a bad one to ask about this kind of legislation philosophically, although I suppose I'll probably go along with it, because nobody else will agree with me. But philosophically, I'm opposed to this kind of legislation. It's the same argument that you could make in a child abuse situation. That more and more legally we are allowing people to point their fingers at another person without standing up and making themselves known.
Kind of like we're going against the Fifth Amendment.
That's right.
The right to face your accuser.
That's right. And it's very disturbing to me. And it's twice in one night we have it. And I know I've fought this battle down to judiciary and the Civil Services Division. And of course,
I can see this more direct than I can the child abuse, where I think that we're protecting the child, and maybe there is a little difference about facing your accuser, because we have the jurisdiction and the child really not being involved. But this one I can see where you're really talking about the individual facing his accuser. My own feeling about this is, and maybe this amendment takes care of it, but I don't worry about you, but I worry about the next guy coming along and bearing a complaint too.
That's a great addition to the bill.
Yeah, because I know you're going to bring it out, but I can also see this administrator that was in the other pocket who also would bury the complaints because he didn't have to answer to anybody.
Can I point out that I brought copies of the public reports that you made in your
counsel? Yeah, he did bring us some of these, which you might want to look at to see the kind of material he's dealing with. That was another thing.
Yeah,
this is not unrealistic. We have watched this in liquor commissions and other things where we've seen these kind of people just take a peck against them. As I said, we don't worry about you.
But what do they do? I'm sorry, I
haven't heard. Well, if you wanted to abuse somebody, you could just have all kinds of complaints against this individual, which you don't have to show anything. You just write them up any way you want and harass somebody to death. I'm not saying that you're the one that's going to do this, but we have seen this happen in other agencies. It's not that uncommon.
Well, I think there's a lot of sense in the amendment will help prevent that abuse.
Mr.
Chairman, I'd like to ask the administrator how he checks out liquefy LL.
What was that? Where is that now?
The last one. You're walking up to the top.
Oh,
that's what they call watering the jello.
No,
it's
soft.
Have you ever eaten in the hospital lately? I always wonder how you take care of these. I had a father that was a tremendous complainer, and when he was in the hospital for a while, there was absolutely nothing that was there. We went in and we thought that, you know, things were pretty good. To him, they were impossible. And he went to a nursing home for a while,
before we could bring him home, because he had this thing where the hospital was too expensive to bring. But nothing was there. They could have served him T-bone steaks every night, and he'd have been complaining because he didn't get tenderloin.
This is why we don't ever report until we investigate. He's not reporting the indictment before we've gone to find out what happened. That tells us somebody's come and find out.
Mm-hmm.
Like Marge has, what, this is the first time coming to the only place to come in the last week, whether they checked out or not. We finally pointed out that we're going to make a progress, so one front of the flow, that's the main. We never can get to it. So
I don't mean to be unsympathetic, but I sometimes think people who are sick, demanding lots of attention, one of the only recourse they have is to bitch and gripe about everything, you know. And I'm not unlike that myself.
If Representative Ingalls called you up and made a complaint against the nursing home and said, I will only tell you what I have to tell you, I have a complaint, but I will only tell you what it is if you promise not to divulge my name. And you say, okay, I won't, and then he shouts it. But if I call you up and say, I'm very concerned about the conditions in the nursing home, but I don't want to get involved, I won't tell you what my name is, but I will tell you what the problem was. Would you investigate both of them?
Yes, I would, but if I were examined as to whether or not I knew who had called me in each case, and you had never told me your name, nor listened down, and he had, I'd have to say, I'm in the present state of the law, yes, I know who called me, because Representative Ingalls who called me.
I don't see what's wrong with that. The people that are afraid to get the basis of the law, I understand from your standpoint, is that you will get more complaints. The people will be more open about getting the complaints.
That's correct.
So you've already got right here one anonymous complainant.
For people who are smart enough to stay anonymous, this statute is not needed. For the good, solid, simple-minded citizen, unsophisticated citizen, who writes the letter and tells us about it, and then gets correct.
But I think that's kind of his duty as a citizen.
To get arrested?
Well, he's got, if he wants to make a complaint and he's sure of it, then he's got to stand his ground.
I'll give you an example. It happened to a man that now works for him. He was not then employed by the health division. He lived in a water district in North Platte. And he just raised the devil about zoning because he felt the area was being filled up too fast. There wasn't adequate water, the streets weren't adequate. And the lawyer for the developers just called him and said, look, I'm going to sue you if you say that again. And he said, well, so what? Go ahead. He said, did you know the conscience? Should we defend him?
Well, you know what you should do in that case, and you should call the Oregon State Bar or tell that man, because that attorney could be disbarred for that kind of conduct.
Sir Washburn, who was not an unsophisticated person, didn't know that. He looked at what he had, what it was costing, and backed off.
But that doesn't justify this kind of legislation.
Well, I don't mean to. I need to argue about that.
Courtney, would you object if you put in there an unsubstantiated complaint would have to have his name disclosed?
No, sir, because unsubstantiated and unfounded are two different things. The complaint may be perfectly well substantiated in the mind of the person who complains. There's something that's dirty out there. It smells bad, for example. We may find that, yes, it's not a bed of roses, but it is not a violation. But the person in the
I'm thinking about the protection for this individual or this institution who says that to keep them from this guy who just has this sort of thing against him and just wants to complain. You know, he's constantly, if I can use that word, just bitching, and he has somebody just throwing in complaints, and they're unsubstantiated or
And it will say so right there in that report.
Yeah, but then that person ought to, that would almost be under harassment, wouldn't it? And that person's name ought to be disclosed. A guy who has a real legitimate complaint, and he's bringing this out in the open. I'm just asking a question. I'm not saying. I'm just thinking about what Norma's talking about, that there ought to be some protection from this, for this individual against the kind of person who's just going to, I'm going to get you in trouble business type of thing, you know.
Well,
this
is one of the places where the original language, I think, has an advantage, because it does allow the administrator to say, it's necessary administering the laws to say to you, Mr. Jones, we're just not going to put into print what you say about this nursing home because we've already checked out four times in the last 3 months and none of them were true. And so we're not going to put it in print. You won't have the right to be yours in the case. Now, in fact, that's making a super confidential. That's making the fact of the complaint confidential. If you think that's what you're requesting, then you say that.
Well, I'm requesting if he had these constant complaints and he got in the paper, then the person who runs that institution ought to have some recourse against this individual
who can't substantiate what he's talking about because he's only trying to harass us.
The
individual they're having, he's in the paper every time he turns
to the only legitimate part I know about would be a lawsuit. And if the person is effectively judgment-proof, as many of our people in nursing homes are, they don't have assets of their own. They may not be on welfare, but they're being paid for by relatives, and you can't attach their social security. The only recourse there is the thing which we see occasionally, is the physical mistreatment. And that I don't think any of us would countenance as
against
the
person that
you would either. But men, the preponderance of these people, who would do the thing you're talking about, I think are effectively judgment-proof anyway.
I have a question. Have you had how many cases on two points? One of physical abuse or harassment of the patient to make a complaint when the name is known, and two, employees being removed or fired or run out or demoted or instead of making a complaint when the name is known?
I can't give you a answer. I can tell you this. I know of at least one where the woman was threatened and the nurse has come before the committee of the committee. She complained that her attorney, the attorney's the nurse, will not have a letter threatening her with sue to me or anyone else. I've had a number of cases, some of which I mentioned in the last meeting, where people have said, if we work here, we're afraid we will get fired, or we're sure we will get fired. And one case we didn't want to add it, was to contact you. But time and again, that thread runs through it. And the most dangerous thing is not really whether the harassment will occur, the dangerous thing is enforcement. The passive mode of enforcement we use, we don't have a cop on every corner. The dangerous thing is that the human exists, that there will be reprisal. The fear of reprisal, or harassment, whether it's harassment of the patient, or is I had one came in from Representative Roberts about 2 weeks ago. A fellow complained. The woman, the nurse, she called the doctor, had her own call the doctor. Within the 3 hours, the nurse at home had called back to her and said, we don't want any black marks. So on the next afternoon, the family was ordered to move the patient because he was non-grata there. And they were ordered to move him and there was nothing anybody could do about it. They moved him. Didn't matter whether he wanted to move him. Didn't matter whether he paid the bill. He was thrown out of there. Have you verified the deal?
I'm always one of these kind of people. I can't help it. I always have to, connect everything into my own personal experience, And my personal experience doesn't fit what happens in Portland or somewhere like that, but I do remember hearing some complaints one time about one of our homes, which happens to be run by the Catholic sisters. And I heard this complaint like they had 160 people up there and the cook was only allowed to use 12 dozen eggs, which wasn't full amount, and that they worked them to death. And it was awfully hard for me when we did go up there and take a look, because the sisters worked so hard, and they expected everybody else to work this hard. And the sisters were running a beautiful establishment, but at the same time, nobody was ever turned away, whether they could get welfare money or anything else. And most of the people that were griping there were the kind, in my experience on this, were those kind who... because they didn't pay too much money or anything else, and they got that kind of help, and none of them really wanted to work.
Now, let me explain what we would have investigated out of that. Yeah. We would have gone to investigate the dietary and furnished records to see if the people were getting an adequate diet.
Mm-hmm.
We would have paid no attention to the charge that the labor was overworked. We would have checked to see if they had enough hours of service there to take care of the patients already around them.
Uh-huh.
But we wouldn't have entertained or investigated the complaint of nurses A so-and-so that she was being overworked. That's a private relationship between her and her wife. That's not
But these were the kind of complaints that we heard. And here I, you know, went up there. I'm looking at a tremendous amount of devoted people giving and actually running that darn thing at a loss, you know.
But you wouldn't have found us in there with any kind of investigation at all, except to check the bank to make sure that the people were getting a proper caloric intake of a balanced diet. But we would have gone, and the allegations were being underfed. So I think the first one who got on that was the people who came to. I was anonymous, and finally, the police station gave them a name because the police didn't even check it out. They wanted to see what got there. And we just said, look, there's nothing we can do about it unless we're not. But there
is that piece of fact. All right, Representative English.
Right. I just have an anathema about not being allowed to face your accuser. Is there any other way we can go about this through the back door by disciplining some way a nursing home that attempts to do, like you just reiterated, relative to kicking a patient out in revenge or unbuckling the seatbelt that somebody should be tied in or... Can we approach that in another direction?
I wish I knew a way. I would like to differ with you on one point. I don't think that this bill has in it any hope of the question of facing your accuser. That constitutional right deals with the person who has accused you of a crime. These are not the accusers. If someone complains to me that people are being mistreated in nursing home, being put in hot baths, excessive temperature, the accuser is my agent who goes out there and observes the facts and comes and swears on a complaint. There is the accuser, and that person should be faced and should be subjected to cross-examination. But I'm sorry, I cannot agree with you that the word accuser can properly be extended to the person who makes a complaint.
An anonymous complaint?
An anonymous complaint is not the accuser. No one is put to proof of innocence or guilt over that point.
Well,
what a district attorney... Oh, excuse me.
Both of this is an employee who got fired because he was incompetent.
The person was incompetent.
The person was incompetent. And this is one method of revenge. He calls us Tony Bateson and says they have rocks in their cornflakes.
We go look. Now we don't. And the question is, are there rocks in the cornflakes? My investigator will go and examine the cornflake box to see if there are rocks. If my investigator finds rocks in the cornflakes, my investigator will be formed. And will be subject to cross-examination. And all of the proof of the rocks in the front place will be in an open hearing, after which suitable penalties can be levied, if proven, and subject to court appeal. Now there is the accuser, accused, relationship.
Then it's a third party defending the nursing home, is that right? Well, I'm accusing the nursing home of putting rocks in the cornflakes. Your department comes in and makes the defense or the accusation. Is that what you're telling me?
No. You phone me up and say, I won't tell you my name, they've got rocks in their cornflakes. I say, okay, we'll look into it. So we go out and investigate it, look and see there either are rocks or there aren't. If the investigator finds no rocks, nothing happens.
Thank you.
If the investigator does find rocks, the investigator says, the investigator, have found the rocks, and they come in front of me and we put out the statement of charges, which then must be proven. And that investigator can be cross-examined and cross-examined by the
Norma, can I ask you a question about this same thing? Well, I'm going to use suppose, you know, like this. Suppose that I say that they're smoking grass at Grattan's home, and I report this to the district attorney. Would he go get a search warrant to go in Grattan's house and catch him with marijuana and then say, I'm going to prosecute you because I did that?
He has to have the basis to get the search warrant.
That's what I say. He'd have to have me sign my complaint before he'd get it to go and catch him, wouldn't he?
He would have to give some evidence to the judge.
And it would have to be me to do it and sign my name, wouldn't it?
But normally, is that the way it would work, or would a police officer maybe make some surveillance or something, grounds or information for the search warrant?
He could do that, but it's over a period of time. You know, mm-hmm. They could be watching it on a tips occasion.
But he wouldn't go in his house unless I signed the complaint, would he?
That's what you talk about, a complaint. Like, if I want to charge somebody with something, I have to go down.
That's what I'm getting. I'd have to sign the complaint before he takes the action.
No.
That doesn't mean the man is convicted, does it?
No.
If I sign the complaint, then they would take the action. But here you're having a complaint and they're taking the action.
The lawyer can bring you in because he has notice of it at the trial and cross-examine you to the basis of your the foundation. I must tell you with some regret that the departure from this area of the law has happened in the drug cases. It's brought the no knocks and no nothing else, and there's a lot of concern about that.
Yeah, okay, well, I should have picked another subject. But if I go to the police, they've either got to see it, or I've got to have the complaint before they'll
and
make the investigation, won't they?
An official or a notary or a witness.
They will not go arrest on my word.
I'm going to ask
the answer to that thing is that if I go to Gortmaker and suggest that a felony has occurred, and he calls me before the grand jury, I don't sign anything.
But you are there, the complainant. He can.
But I'm not in open court.
Oh, but you are there for the people that are prosecuting the indictment, and your name, and Mr. Gortmaker is not following law, but he doesn't put your name on the indictment, and we're just passing along Senate Bill 80 that will require him to do that, and he should be doing it. If you're called before the grand jury, and
that's
he's the one that's being charged, and I'm his lawyer, I should know, have a name of the witness that appeared against him in the grand jury, and your name should be on that indictment, and Mr. Gortmaker gets around it. Because he will have you tell the police officer, and the police officer will go in and tell the grand jury. And that's not right, and we're going to fix that.
What if I only suspect that?
I mean, you look for it in Senate Bill 80. We spent 2 weeks on it.
Excuse me, let's say I suspect something is wrong down at the FYZ medical bank. And I say to the business manager, I'm thinking something is wrong down there. The president shouldn't have three Cadillacs in a Rolls Royce. And the bank examiners are called, and they go in and determine that a crime has been committed, and then they report it to the district attorney, who put it in before the grand jury, and
if it depends on the investigation. But let me give you another example of what you're talking about. You say, what happens if I call you up and I say that Senator Ripper's missing home, putting rocks in cornflakes, and you dutifully send your guy out there to find the period. The next day I call up and say, well, today they've got bed bugs, and so you usually send somebody out there, the bed bugs, and every day it's something else, because I want to harass them. I've got, you know, I don't like him, and I don't like his nursing home, and he treated my mother bad, and I do this continually, and you're on a bound to investigate those complaints. But pretty soon he's going to turn around and say, he knows that this is a bunch of harassment, and he should be able to find out who I am and why I'm doing this.
I ought to be able to take your into a court of law.
How has he been harassed? How is any licensee charged with a license violation harassed by a simple inquiry as to the fact or a physical investigation as to the fact?
By
normal procedure, how often do you investigate?
Yeah.
I would say I was being harassed. You came around to inspect my place once every 3 months. But if you were there once every 3 days, then I would say I was being harassed. Because whether you are learned this or not, the mere fact that a state employee comes in with a license, that guy is in fear and trust.
I'd like to know how often that happens, Tony, when somebody is arrested. The House and Senate Joint Committee on Professional Responsibility come to order. Our first order of business will be to have hearings on conflicts of interest bills, of which there are three. We'll start off with the usual professional courtesy of hearing the members of the legislative body first, and we'll begin with Senator Wingard.
Because of their business. How can we have them in their business and
making decisions on legislative matters without having them have to declare conflict of interest in every little specific instance in their trade. Now, I'd like to give you an example of what I mean by being able to continue to do business as a legislator and as a businessman and not be in conflict of interest, and an example of how you would be in conflict of interest under the same situation. Say we had a bill requiring the development of an auditorium, a statewide auditorium in a particular area, and say you're a developer. Now, if this bill just came up on the basis that the auditorium could be located any place, then you wouldn't be in conflict of interest as a developer, because you don't have any particular advantage in this situation. But if the bill said specifically that the building shall be located, the auditorium shall be located on the block 10, lot 4, and you happen to own lot 10 and block 4, then you would be in conflict of interest. This could also apply to attorneys. In general, attorneys have faced many items during the legislative session which would affect them in general. As long as that's a general effect, this bill would not apply. But if there was some specific case that you would be working on, or if there's some specific expertise of law that you're working in, say you represent certain corporations that would be directly affected, then this bill would cause you to have to relate the fact that you might have a conflict of interest. My one suggestion of changing the bill, Mr. Chairman, would be on line 21, section 3, instead of on or before January 15th, the date should be changed to July 15th, and I make this suggestion because it would be better after the actual session to have these things listed than before the session. Because when you go down to line 26A, the source and amount of income received by a member, it would be better after the session to relate to particular sources than before the session.
Well, we got a whole slug of them.
Or the sorcerer amount of gift, an aggregate sum of over $150. It would be better to have those listed after the actual legislative session. That would be just a change on page 2. Then on page 3, I would suggest after line 27, after conflict, the language be changed to read, or who has failed to disclose any financial information required under section 3 of this act.
Are there questions, Senator Wingard? Molly?
Chairman George, did you consider an annual filing? You referenced with January 15th versus July 15th. How about a January 15th if we're going to move into annual sessions either one way or another?
I struggle with that, and I thought, well, let's change that the time we do get into
annual sessions. Are we there? I understand you. Perhaps you and I are not the ones to consider that. I'll ask somebody else who might have to say about that.
Are there other questions? George, Section 5, during each session of the Legislative Assembly, you don't think that legislators, line 9, may commit acts that need censure when the legislature is not in session, but while they are still legislators?
Could well be one of them that time.
What does censure mean?
Well, censure has your attorneys on your committee can tell you. Censure, in legislative terms, has a broad historical meaning, and one of them can probably tell you better. I checked with legislative counsel to the exact meaning, and they told me, well, any attorney would know that it has broad legislative meaning. In essence, it eliminates the person from really being effective. Once you're censured, you're really no longer an effective member of any legislative body. Maybe more due to publicity than any other reason. Maybe one of the attorneys would like to comment on it.
Senator Halleck, do you have any thing you'd like to add to the statements by Senator Wingard?
No, Mr. Chairman, except to lend a bipartisan cast to the bill and the support of the bill, and the fact that for the first 4 or 6 or 8 years of my term in the Senate, it was looked upon as some radical concept to share with the people who we were, what we did, what our holdings were, and I, for one, don't fear it. I filed my list of accounts with the Associated Press, and Frank Wetzel conducted a poll. I was a little bit disgruntled to find out that no newspaper I knew of general circulation except the Daily in Salem printed his full list. Nonetheless, we should be on the record. I think Watergate, in its way, in its perverse way, simply fortifies the reasons why we should stand up and be counted. It's something to be ashamed of, what we do for a living. I would like to add, Mr. Chairman, in my own opinion, as to what censure means. The censure means, in the case of the late Senator McCarthy, the holding up to public scrutiny what one has done, and to express to the member that the body is displeased. And in the case of this particular kind of censure, I'm sure the reason for censure would be spoken so that the public would know that the member had withheld certain data that the public was entitled to have, would speak reasons for, in the field of the public punishment. I think Senator Wingard may have misstated himself when he said that the member so censured wouldn't in fact be a member of the body. I'm sure he or she would be, but the public would have a chance to know what the deceit or concealment was.
I didn't mean to say that.
I think you said effective member of the body, Judge. I'm not sure.
That's very probable.
I also just passed out a copy of Mason's rules, which I stumbled upon when I was considering how I would vote on the tax plan. I felt I was in deep conflict of interest on this particular measure because I would receive a five-figure financial tax break under the plan, and I felt this was a conflict of interest, and I searched the rules of the Senate, and under Mason's 522.3, there is a specific clause which almost takes the language that is included in this bill, and specifically states a member may not vote to give himself money or direct financial benefits. So there is sufficient precedent, I think, in our present rule to allow to give emphasis to this kind of legislation.
Senator Hurd, do you have any questions or two
witnesses? Yeah.
I have one, while we're waiting around. How much financial interest do you feel that you have to have in a corporation, for instance, before it becomes one of declaring this? How much stock do you think you ought to own? Let's pick a company just out of the air, like Weyerhaeuser or U.S. National Bank or something like this. What point do you think it would become a personal interest?
Well, I think any time that you're going to gain any advantage that the average guy can't gain by the vote that you make, you have a conflict of interest, you should declare it. Now, if in tax committee, if we're discussing severance tax, and if you had stock in Weyerhaeuser Company, maybe 100 shares, and the severance tax is increased or decreased from 5% to 3%. To me, that's a conflict of interest. It should be so stated.
What about people who might have, say, interest in stock in a group of companies, in a, what do you call those?
Mutuals.
But yet you would have certain great financial interest in these. You could have an awful lot of shares of, say, investor syndicate or something like this.
I think the definition is your decision is going to directly benefit you financially. I think you should be careful of how decisions are made on that basis. And incidentally, I'm deeply concerned about how we'll be negotiating salaries, Jack, and I'm not poking at you, but if we negotiate salaries in the legislature, for instance, for teachers, I think that we're going to have to look at whether we have a conflict of interest in that particular case.
Are there any other questions or comments? Thank you very much, gentlemen. We appreciate you coming down. Senator Fadley on 2529.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the courtesy of the committee and hearing from the legislators first. I'm one of a number of sponsors of House Bill 2529, which is introduced at the request of Common Cause. The sponsors there include Senator Halleck, who is on both of these bills. I think 2529 is a more comprehensive bill and one that we should consider strongly here. I believe that it is wise to disclose all of the pecuniary interests that are of importance. There are some guidelines in the bill for that, and then with that disclosure on public record, you don't have to consider each time there is a vote whether or not you will be claiming a conflict of interest. I think that it's appropriate for a person who doesn't want to vote on the basis of a conflict to mention it. But simply standing up on a day of the session when we are voting on 20 or 30 measures and mentioning your conflict on that measure will not adequately inform the voters in your district of the actual substantial interest you have. Probably by the time of the next meeting, I will have filed a statement which is generally in compliance with House Bill 2529, and it will be made public with regard to the press. I looked especially at the provisions of 2529 on what they would consider as an economic or financial conflict, and will be complying with that publicly, even though it is not the law.
the bill, especially on page 6, is a little harder on lawyers than it is on anybody else because of the detail in which lawyers are asked to report. But I believe that that is the kind of information that should be available to people, and I find no problem in my own ethics stating who has hired me over the years for specific purposes. It's entirely possible that there have been people on the payroll of a specific conflict having a legislative interest during legislative session. I speak in terms of past history. That's entirely possible, and this bill would really bring that to the light of day and make it clearly only a historical practice. The emphasis is very much more on public information about the financial interest of the member of the decision-making body or group, and much less on a declaration just before the vote that you have a conflict and want to miss voting on that specific thing. That declaration wouldn't serve to inform the public generally of your conflict. This requires prior reporting, in effect, also, so that people would know in advance before the issue was hot or was joined on a specific bill whether you had an economic interest in it. My criticism of all of the bills is that the assumption is that the only kind of conflict of interest you can have is an economic conflict. That may be the only one that can be handled very easily, but there are other kinds of conflicts of interest arising from family ties or past history of relatives or other things of that kind, which do influence a person's growth. We all live in common experience, and there's no way we can avoid having a set of ideas and interests and affiliations when we come to the legislature. It's impossible for a legislator to be hatched out of an egg on a Sunday before the session starts on Monday. He must have some interest that he comes with. But it would be a substantial improvement over the existing situation to pass a bill like 2529, and I say I'm going to comply with the financial reporting portions of it publicly and think that it's really not all that difficult to do. It was somewhat interesting to me to go back through my records to find out who was paying me how much and what were the sources of my income, because I really didn't know the amount or the magnitude of any of the particular interest without checking the record. I did know who had me on retainer on a month-to-month basis, but I didn't understand how much I was making from one to the other until I actually went back and checked it. Senator Ripper's question about stock, if you just report the stock that you own, and I know that you might change your ownership, then you're not really called on to determine whether that mutual fund has a lot of holdings in oil or something else. You've made a public disclosure about that. I don't want to impose on courtesy accorded legislators to speak first by speaking longer.
Jack Harris, Wally?
And perhaps somebody from Common Cause will speak to this one, but I have a number of questions, but the one I was concerned about was on page 6, line 6, we're talking about the statement of disclosure that you're talking about. It says the name of each business, insurance policy, or trust in which he or a member of the financial interest. What are they trying to get at there?
Well, the business is plain. The insurance policy, I think, they have amended that out because of the wisdom of questions like the one you just asked.
Well, okay, I've seen the amendment. And the other question, Chair, if I may. I believe they also took out the requirement that every state employee who received $600 file a declaration. Is that out now, too?
You mean that legislators are exempt from that?
No. No, legislators are probably one of the groups the most covered by this.
We fall into number 7 on section 2, right?
Exactly.
Public officials.
If I might say that public officials, many people making more than $600 a month wouldn't really be affected very much with their public business, or not too much, so that didn't seem to be too burdensome to have that many reports for the amount of information that you would get. We want to cover the subject but disclose as much as is possible, sort of like a women wearing skirt.
Ed, I have a couple of questions. Now, you're not saying, though, that if I got up and declared I had a, supposing I was a builder and I had a financial interest in building, if I got up and declared that we're going to vote on a uniform building code or a way to use new plastic pipe or something, and now, if I declared I had an interest in the building business, are you saying that you're not saying, maybe I should put this way, that I shouldn't vote? I just have to declare that I have an interest in this?
The bill does not, my recollection of the bill does not prevent a person
from voting.
From voting.
It does require him to disclose his interest in advance.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I think it would be really a decision of the members of the House whether to allow him to avoid voting.
But supposing that, well, I'm going to say then, all right, just along that same line, but you might firmly believe this, you know, as a principle, regardless of whether you were a builder or not, that you thought that plastic pipe was the thing, and it ought to be, or we ought to have a state building code. And I think under, I'm not sure, but under our Constitution, doesn't it require you to vote if you're on the floor?
Yeah. Well,
I think the rules.
But didn't Bud Lynch declare himself a couple of times and not vote?
We had it happen once. But
you have to deal with the unanimous consent. Mm-hmm. Generally, we rejected the unanimous consent. That's the kind of rule. That's the rule.
Well, the Constitution says that
sure.
The vote should be taken by A's and nays, which means every name will be called and there'll be an opportunity for him to answer. I don't believe that the question of procedure is entirely settled, but there is custom in the legislature where a person stands up and declares his interest and asks permission that he not be required to vote. And unless there's an objection, that permission has been granted.
But that automatically becomes a no vote, doesn't it?
It surely does.
And if he firmly believed that this was what his people wanted, wouldn't he be in conflict then with his people?
Well, this particular bill, 2529, doesn't get to that point. The other bill that was explained, 145, prevents him from voting and does have the defect you mentioned.
Are there more questions of Senator Fader? Senator Hardin?
On section 12, page 4, do I read that, for instance, the insurance commissioner could not take a job in the insurance business for at least 2 years after he was imposed?
That is included in one of the things that is no longer sought in this bill by common clause. They say common clause does not want that section any longer.
Chairman,
how do
you get a copy of this?
Well, by not having me speak first, I guess, is the solution. Common cause will have them here, and we'll have copies for you. I think they're ready to distribute.
Okay. Section 10, Ed, does this prohibit a couple of members of our present assembly from doing their principal law business?
Well, I can't tell you whether it would or would not, but Section 10 is no longer among the sections sought by common cause.
Okay. Then back here on line 16, page 7, because of the vagaries of the electorate, sometimes representatives are not available for a second two-year term on a legislative commission.
I don't argue with you. I'm not opposed to continuing to serve if he was a member of the time he was appointed, but he might want to resign and then have a new appointment. As far as the law is concerned, it would appear once he's appointed, he should have qualified at the time he was appointed, but he was still today. Let me say that again. It would take some official interpretation, but probably the qualification in the law would have to be met at the time of appointment rather than be retained. There are examples where legislators have been elected from their district, as they must be, have moved completely out of their county, but have retained their position in the legislature for the rest of their term. I think that kind of thing would apply here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, are there any more questions? Thank you.
I thank you very much for your courtesy.
Representative Johnson?
Chairman, I think I'll listen for a final comment.
You may. Representative Gwynn? Fine, that's great. I've just taken you by seniority. All right. Representative Blumenau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to comment very briefly. Extensively coordinated our presentation this evening. We'll try and prevent overlap by being very brief. Some of your earlier testimony of Senator Bailey, started to zero in on a few basic points that I would like to emphasize. First and foremost, I think I'd like to respond to a question that's always asked about where the need for such legislation arises. And it seems to me that if one is persuaded by what you've seen on television or heard in your own district, that there is a decided lack of public confidence in government, I think that you'll be able to go out after the in the aftermath of the election tomorrow, no matter who wins or loses. And I think get a fresh sample that would satisfy anyone at this table that the public has, in my opinion, a decided lack of confidence in public officials. And it's not altogether without some foundation. I see House Bill 2529, another proposal we'll be considering hopefully in the relatively near future, 2530, as trying to zero in on this need and bolster public confidence in their elected officials. There are, I would argue, and I think Representative Quinn would concur, no insurmountable obstacles to enacting conflict of interest legislation. There is admittedly a conflict between the public's right to know versus the right of privacy of certain politicians and bureaucrats. But I would suggest that in such conflict, that the public right to know and the concern of bolstering public confidence in elected and appointed officials ought to win out. There have been some problems, you've already seen them in some of the questions that have come up about the technicalities here in terms of definition, certain provisions of the bill. Both Representative Quinn and myself had the privilege of going over with representatives of Common Cause several drafts. I'm sure what they'll be contributing to you this evening still, I don't think anyone would contend is fixed in stone, it is subject to change, but I think we're starting to zero in, have a much healthier document and one that I think most of the major votes have already been taken out of. Some people contend that there's really no problem here in Oregon. We ought to wait. Since there is no scandal, that this conflict of interest legislation is inappropriate. Now, I would contend just the opposite, that the time to enact conflict of interest legislation, the time to move in this area is before a major scandal breaks out. I think we're seeing on a national level that remedial attempts, efforts that are after the fact, serve only to further erode public confidence. I think they're often hasty, and I think might be damaging to individuals, some of whom might be innocent, who are involved in such problems. The time to act is before we have problems to develop. I have two other very brief comments, and one simply is, I'm convinced, based on the tenor of the input that I've received from my district, which is not highly activistic in nature, that this is really attuned, the public mood at this point in time, and we're going to be faced with some form of sunshine laws and conflict of interest and lobby regulations. And I think you gentlemen and Representative Durelli are going to be faced with how it's going to be enacted. Is it going to go through the legislative process and have fine points tuned, hammered upon, questioned, tell us who likes to look for warts and running sores, or is it going to be through the initiative? I'm convinced that if this legislature does not act in a positive and constructive fashion in the area of conflict of interest and lobby regulation, you are in fact going to have to face an initiative that will be successful probably with 85 or 90% approval from the electorate, and we might find, like some of our neighboring states, that it is less than workable simply because it hasn't had the benefit of legislative scrutiny. Finally, I'd like to suggest an amendment that I've come to feel very strongly about that I don't think is going to be discussed by any one from Common Cause who will be testifying afterwards. And I would like to just suggest that at this time, the concept, and I'd be more than happy to work with the committee to streamline, put it in a form that is workable. But I would suggest that in Section 5, or new Section 5, or a subsection of the existing Section 4 that refers to public officials receiving soliciting gifts or promises or anything of value, that we have a specific language in that section that would prohibit any legislator or a group of legislators from soliciting or accepting campaign contributions for past or future campaigns while the legislature is in session. And I would be happy to come back with specific language if it is the committee's wish to entertain such a concept for amendment in the bill.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, first of all, may I apologize for Common Cause committee members who apparently offended through their separate support of this legislation, perhaps one or more of the members of this committee by lobbying activities in support of the legislation. I'm not sure what the occurrence might have been. I hope that your contact from them I'm sure it will in no way influence your objective, independent attitude towards the legislation itself. First of all, I gathered in the last several months, since this legislation has been in the process of preparation and introduction and waiting for hearing, that there are many who feel that this is some sort of a cops and robbers thing, is going to find great revelations of wrongdoing by politicians and office holders in the state of Oregon. I don't think it's the case at all. I agree with those who say that, on balance, Oregon is a pretty clean state. I'm not so naive as to believe that human nature being such as it is, that we have no purity in the state, but I think, on balance, Oregon is a pretty clean state. It's not going to find any great revelations because, number one, it will hopefully dissuade anyone from such notions and perhaps also encourage cessation of any such activities by its very presence. I've often marveled and long wondered why Oregon is, as I believe it is, relatively clean, because frankly, when you travel primarily in the state east of the Mississippi River, you find that the politics there is almost accepted as an ally or going along with organized crime and hanky-panky and graft and payoff and everything else. And I'm sure there's no one reason, though the larger cities in the east and no one political party has enjoyed a monopoly on political machines of more recent years, perhaps one, but certainly over the current history of both parties, perhaps in part for the reason of immigrants to the country that were beholden by their need for occupation, a job, and the person that dispensed that sort of favor was the happened to be the ward boss that was only a part of the machine, whether it meant a job on the load of the county road grader or the street department or whatever. But in any event, so this is not a cops and robbers type bill. It speaks to the, as Representative Engels put it on the floor the other day, the public's right to know. This committee has associated itself with a package of bills that speak in that direction, including but not limited to the Shield Law, the Public Meetings Bill, and this is simply another in the package of bills speaking to the public's right to know. I'm very sure, this is the whole subject of personal disclosure, if you will, of personal finances. Most, if not all, of us hold with some reservation. And I would have to be the first to confess to you that I share some of that reservation. I'm not at all sure that I enjoy the thought of next-door neighbor or whatever busybody that's sure for their own idle curiosity want to know my financial affairs has any real relevance to my ability to serve my constituency. But I'm also sure that I am not the most logical person, namely the person in question or holding the office, to pass judgment upon whether or not my financial affiliations or involvements in any way affect my ability to serve the people. And in the final analysis, the people must be the judge of that question. As an indication of my good faith, I am one of two legislators at the present time who have made a public filing with the Secretary of State of my financial statements. It does not comply entirely with the requirements of this bill. It's a balance sheet as such for normal loan or bank purposes, and I'm in the process of preparing a more comprehensive statement that will afford you the whole picture detail to comply with the bill. And I'm not here to debate with Representative Blumenauer because I think he and I are about 99% in concurrence on this legislation, but on the subject of solicitation during legislative sessions, I would hope that with a meaningful campaign limit bill, the Senate number escapes me, with a meaningful bill there, placing realistic and meaningful limits upon political campaigns, that some of the necessity to solicit during legislative sessions to balance the deficit budgets and or build a war chest for the next campaign might be very, very, very much less. But if that be not the case, then certainly I think that Representative Blumenauer can speak to a valid question of the position that it places upon those with respect to being solicited during a session, the implications of at least the timing and their relevance to their activity versus other things that might take place or not take place during a session. A subsequent witness is going to go over the suggested amendments to the bill. I apologize, but you have not been presented with some suggested amendments to the bill, and a subsequent witness, Mr. Chairman, will go through the bill with those suggested amendments for you.
Thank you, Mr. Gwynn. Are there any questions for the Gold Dust Twins? No.
could have had before.
Well, I had one, Earl, relative to your suggested amendment, and I agree certainly in principle, but I wondered, a number of legislators contributed $50 recently to a campaign that's now in process. Would this exclude that?
It would, in my judgment, I think language could be drawn to allow legislators themselves to contribute to campaigns, but it would prohibit the solicitation, active solicitation, I think, of, well, let me rephrase that. I think that potentially something like this could lend itself to abuse. You know, who's going to contribute to what? Is a game that can be played with, could be played with legislators, just like it could be played with lobbyists, in the terms of which it's going to be contributed. I guess as I originally suggested, that would be that they would have to have somebody else do the soliciting for them among themselves, or it would be illegal. I guess technically what the situation you're talking about would be prohibited. I would think that'd be a very rare occurrence that we have legislators contributing a great deal of their own money to political campaigns.
Can't do that.
I certainly agree with both of you gentlemen that what we need to do is to improve the credibility of government, not so much change the action as change the possible appearance of the problem of using why we need to look completely open whether or not anything's wrong. I'm interested in the limits at which we can, the limits we impose on the public office holder. I'm really not in disagreement with your amendment, Earl, because I've never gotten any money is what I did at the legislative session, and I know anyway, I'm more apt to give my opponents some. But I'm curious about the First Amendment. Maybe you could keep an office holder from soliciting, but I'm not quite sure how you could keep a citizen from contributing to a future campaign or a past campaign at any time and abide by the First Amendment. He has the right to really get into the political process as much as he wants to. Making this road, but I wonder, is there any history, is there anybody else that you know where they have prohibited contributions for 6 months out of the year, or what may well turn out to be 12 months out of the year before they're long out
of here? Senator Fadley.
Senator, I think that there is no precedent that I'm aware of for the specific provision I'm suggesting. However, we have had federal prohibitions for certain types of people making certain contributions. We've had them for decades. The fact is they've been winked at, but when they have been challenged in court, they have been sustained. And I think we're getting into the whole question of campaign spending limitations. We're going to kind of be pulling out this area. I appreciate any time you're in First Amendment territory that's sensitive, and I really admire you folks for what you've done to date in the session in this delicate area. But I really believe that the precedents that I'm familiar with in examining it from for other legislation relative to campaign spending indicates to date the court hasn't had any problem in deeming constitutional reasonable limitations, and I think that it would not be a quantum leap for the court to deem a reasonable regulation the prohibition of campaign contributions during legislative session.
Mr. Chairman, one other remark. You
Earl, I'd like to ask a question about Section 3. It says no public official shall use his official position or office to obtain financial gain for himself, for any member of his household, or for any business with which he or a member of his household is associated. When you were in the insurance business, is this going to take you out of selling city insurance or schools insurance? This might be a regular way for you to make your living, but from then on you're going to be somewhat in doubt, aren't you?
Right.
So this would practically eliminate insurance salesmen from the legislature, wouldn't it?
If they make their livelihood principally by hawking their wares to other governmental agencies or to lobbyists or to corporations that are concerned with legislation, yes. And I'm not.
Well, I'm thinking about a little insurance agency in a small town. He primarily, his big customers are schools government agencies, which he would, I mean,
right.
He has to have these. He can't live on automobiles alone.
Then I suggest that
this would eliminate these people.
And I think that if in that precise that situation, he has no business being on the school board, if that's a major way.
Well, he would be here in the legislature is what you'd remove him from.
Now, I don't think you have to construct it that narrowly. I don't think he could...
It says any business which he is a member of his household is associated with it. It'd be pretty hard to sell insurance without being involved in this, I would think. Now, maybe I'm reading it closer than you are, but I would think it would be pretty hard to be an insurance salesman.
Bill, do you have an interpretation?
Well, no, but I, this is no answer to Senator Rivers' concerns, except to point out that, relevant to us, that this bill goes far beyond legislators, and it's the one of several major differences between this bill and 145 is that it speaks not only to legislators, but to all public officials, with the philosophy being that there are as many, if not more, opportunities for conflict of interest at other levels of government as there are in the legislature.
So, yeah, I realize that.
On the local level, planning and zoning commissions, councils, whatever.
What he's asked is, would this bill preclude Bob Elliott, for instance, from serving on the legislature?
What section are you on?
Section 3, on page 3.
Don't agree with your reading of that. If you're reading from the revised Common Cause draft number 17 or something like that,
I'm reading from the new one that they
right.
just gave.
Now, shall use his official position or office to obtain financial gain for himself. Now he's using the state his position as a state legislator to somehow secure business.
Well, if you were but if you were on the school board. And the city bought insurance, or on the city council, for instance, and the school board, how are you going to determine whether they bought that because he's on the city council or just because he was a good salesman? Anybody would be open to challenge, I would think, on anything he sold.
Mr. Chairman, this matter has come up in Marion County. A school board member who had a substantial contract, and it was on insurance, and it got down to a renewals on a 3-year contract. He wasn't even before. And I believe both the city attorney there and I think the attorney general ruled that that was a conflict of interest and he resigned the school board. And I think he should have, frankly. Mm-hmm. I agree with Earl. I don't think this...
But he's selling to that, but if he's selling to another one, you see.
Well, but I think Representative Blumenauer's point is well taken, and that is you have to use your official position to obtain financial gain. In other words, if you were passing bills or going down and saying now there's a bill coming up, but I sure appreciate your insurance business because I'm about to vote on that bill. He's clearly qualified here, but I think Earl's explained pretty well.
We have other cases, Senator, and just the one that comes immediately to mind is when I was speaking here in another committee this afternoon, where port commissioners, people who are on the Port of Portland, an example was cited, one port commissioner who, since the prohibition is that he, being a port commissioner, he cannot use that position actively to improve himself financially. Has had to forego probably $100,000 in contracts that otherwise he would have been able to win on a competitive bid. That's one of the prices that one pays for public service. You either forego the business or you forego the position. But I think that is much preferable to have someone serving and have the suspicion, whether real or imagined, of someone using this public office for their own financial betterment. I think this is something that we've probably been amiss at not moving on earlier and being about the enforcement of existing provisions.
I realize what you're driving at, but I can also see a lot of conflict here. An attorney goes out and Weyerhaeuser hires him. Did they hire him because he passed a good timber law, or did they hire him? In fact, I could just hardly see an attorney staying in business unless they went into divorce business without having somebody challenge him every time he took on a business, a major corporation or anything like this for a client. Because every time we deal some way or another with corporations.
That's where all these bills, I think, are advancing a very important concept. When we have an ethics commission rationally appointed and some place that we can refer to when there are questions, we have borderline areas. We don't have to be stuck on strict literal interpretation of law. We have a body that can go to and consider mitigating evidence and help to arrive at the proper decision. And I think that in this regard, that all three of the bills that are before you have a great deal of merit.
I see no problem with full-time people, but I certainly see this is a big area for part-time politicians.
Well,
Bill,
whether it be for city or for a state.
Bill, you've been around here for quite a while, and there have been other suggestions for ethics bills and conflict of interest. Do you think the time has come that we can get one through the body?
Well, I'm not going to predict the whims of my fellow legislators after watching that at 6 p.m. this evening. I think the time has come for the public to demand it.
Okay. Are there any other questions of these witnesses? Thanks very much, gentlemen. Did Representative Patterson leave? Let's have the Common Cause people explain the amendments and appear in that.
Come up as a group.
We'd appreciate it if you'd come up all together if you want to, or as a.
First, or do you want to ask us questions about the amendments first?
No, let's have the prepared statement first, please.
My name is Ralph Bunch. I reside in Portland, Oregon, and I'm the chairman of the 1st and 3rd Congressional District of Common Cause. I'd like to read a statement to you. Democracy is an act of faith. Citizens, in establishing a democratic form of government, entrust their most precious possessions to a few of their fellow citizens, share the fruits of their labors, control over their life, liberty, and their pursuit of happiness, and the power to achieve or frustrate their most cherished dreams. Thus, the holding of public office, as you ladies and gentlemen well know, is a serious and solemn undertaking. By and large, the success of our society in its quite unique form of government is founded on the faithful service that countless public officials have rendered in our 200 years as a nation. Yet no reasonable person can deny that there have been, from time to time in all communities, seldom in some, quite usually in others, a defiance of the general rule of faithful service. Common Cause and Conflict of Interest Bill, which we are asking you to consider, is a response to the behavior of the few and is aimed at protecting the many from an undeserved reputation by which the general public holds politicians and bureaucrats to be less meritorious than their accomplishments should reflect. A restoration of the vitality and effectiveness of our governmental system, we suggest, is imperative and possible only by restoring the faith that the general public must have in its public employees and officials. We offer this bill as a device for accomplishing the following specific objectives: clarifying and calling to the attention of all public officers the nature and seriousness of conflicts of interest, erecting a formidable barrier to public service before those few who would intentionally seek to use official positions for private gain, providing the public interest with a substantial weapon to deal with those few who would, in their greed, ignore or attempt to frustrate the barrier of public disclosure of conflicts of interest. And lastly, assuring our citizens that their public officers collectively are determined to police their own ranks and merit the confidence the people have placed in them. The bill we have submitted to you is not perfect. Conflict of interest legislation is rather a new field. Only a handful of states have passed such legislation, and that has been only in very recent few years. Consequently, we have sought out the opinions and suggestions of legislators and others with knowledge and experience in the matters we have attempted to deal with, and our original bill of last January has gone through innumerable modifications. We are satisfied now that it is practical, reasonable, moderate, and needed. We have made this bill's strongest portions applicable to a minimum number of officeholders. Experience in operation over the next few years will undoubtedly provide an appropriate basis for future modifications and possibly extensions. Specifically, the bill contains these major provisions applying to all public employees and officials. One, a general prohibition against the use of office for private gain through gifts aimed at influence, the misuse of confidential information, such as in real estate purchase or contract bidding situations, the use of official power for extra compensation, such as in the rendering of advice and representation normally a part of the job. And two, the formal acknowledgement of and withdrawal from conflict of interest situations, such as employment in regulatory activities by those with associated economic interests. That applies to all public employees and officials. And then, applying only to a very much smaller group, this. The bill further requires the filing of a conflict of interest statement with a state ethics committee by these special classes of public employees. All local, state, and national elected officials, other than the President and Vice President of the United States. all officers appointed by and serving at the pleasure of elected officials, except, of course, the appointees of the president. All employees of regulatory agencies who also have an economic interest in the activity regulated by their employer agency. The bill creates a 5-man ethics commission empowered to maintain, summarize, and make available to the public information required to be filed. The commission may investigate on the basis of complaints and information and is required to report violations to appropriate law enforcement authorities. The commission may also render advisory opinions. Intentional violation of this act is punishable by fine and imprisonment. Lastly, provision is made for citizen legal action through the circuit court. We in Common Cause are convinced that the public wants a conflict of interest bill. In our neighboring state of Washington, a strong bill was passed by initiative with a 300,000 plurality of votes. California's legislature is at this moment considering a bill in many respects stronger than that we are recommending to you. The people need to be reassured. The news every day erodes their confidence. An act of foresight and statesmanship is called for, and Common Cause stands ready to aid new members of the legislature, eager to answer that call. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions of Dr. Bench? Okay. You want to go through the amendments then?
You might be interested a little bit in how we have gone through this process. We have a group of us, probably 10 to 15 of us, have been intimately involved in all four of Common Cause's packages. That's the open meeting, conflict of interest, lobbying, and campaign spending. And we meet formally every 2 weeks, but through the week in countless other sessions, and we've talked with countless legislators. I would especially like to note that that we have talked recently in the last 2 weeks at length with Tom Enright of the OSEA, and I found his counsel to be very valuable. In fact, he suggested that the third category of employees to come under the requirement of filing conflict of interest statements, and he came to that position by reading the ORS on regulatory agency, public utility commission, and suggested that to us as a way of reducing the burden on public public employees at the lowest levels across the board. And we were glad to have his insight, and we internalized that in our bill. We have talked with numerous attorneys, numerous legislators, and with other public officials and citizens concerned that all of their comments, because this is such a new area, all of their comments could help us. We want to assure you that we are flexible, we want a reasonable bill, and we want to have a bill that we will be proud to have submitted, and we don't want to offer you a bill and try to push through a bill that would embarrass us a year from now because of its unworkability. So our interest is the same as yours in developing the best law possible for the state of Oregon. Now, as to the specifics, we have taken out certain of the most those parts that have appeared to be the most burdensome to public officials and have turned out, in our judgment, to be those particular ones that we would have the most difficulty with. So the image that this bill got in its first form is not a valid image for you to have at this point, because right across the board, I would say 90% of the complaints that we heard in those first couple of months have been eradicated from the bill. Now, as to specifics, I could spend probably 15 or 20 minutes going through these amendments. I'm not sure you want to do that. I wonder if you want to go through and ask us specifics that concern you, because a good deal of it will be obvious to you as you glance through it. I think it might save your time.
This is very much appreciated. Could you tell us briefly, you said 90% of the complaints have been eliminated. What areas are we talking about here?
We have reduced the applicability of the filing of conflict of interest statements only to elective officers, those appointed directly by elective officers and serving at their pleasure, and those public employees who serve in regulatory activities who have also an economic interest in the activity that is being regulated. So not every employee of a regulatory agency must file a conflict of interest statement. But if he or a member of his family has a gravel pit and he is working in the highway commission, then he would have to file a statement of economic interest. All elected officials, county, local, state, federal, includes congressmen and senators, but not presidential candidates. And candidates, I should say, all elected officials plus candidates. On declaring candidacy, a person is also then required 10 days after the deadline for filing for candidacy to submit a statement of economic interest.
Will we require congressmen
and senators,
U.S. House
representatives, U.S. Senate? Yes. Well, we have gone through this a number of times. What convinces us that we can is that they must meet now in order to run for office the requirements of the Secretary of State in regard to Oregon election laws, and this is legitimately part of an election law in that sense, that it can be required of a person in filing for candidacy that he also do this.
What about after the election?
Well, if he is filed, it's on. That's right. If there's a necessity for updating it yearly, substantial changes would be updated yearly. Now, surely a senator could ignore that and just not do it and face the wrath of the public 6 years later, but he'd have a 6-year free ride yet.
I suspect he would face it for that.
Perhaps.
Senator Carson?
Ralph, I'm having a little hard piecing together the change. The bill was drafted originally on the basis that it was going to affect all state employees over 600. Now this has been worked out to zero in on those particular areas of potential conflict. But directing your attention to page 2, line 17, we have rather broad definitions of candidate for public office, starting line 15, means any person who's filed a declaration of candidacy or petition up there on a ballot. Okay, that's pretty easy. Now, then we go on and say any person who has accepted nomination, and I'm going to ask you why the words are changed and do they really get at the problem now as you rephrase it for appointment as a public official, remembering a public official is defined down as any state employee. So my two questions, I guess, are why did you change it? And two, does that really get at, are we back to picking up state employees, which I thought we're taking out? Have I clouded it? I'm sorry.
No, it's a good question, and the answer is, originally it said had been nominated. It was in my suggestion we made this change. And my feeling was that we couldn't require of somebody some action because of what somebody else had done, but instead require it of him because of his action. And so we must require filing a statement on the fact that he made the choice of accepting the nomination. Now, probably in most cases, the person has to accept before he is appointed. So it's really semantic.
Yeah, that's what my next point is. You really don't accept the nomination, you accept the appointment. I was going to say, but we have Senate Bill 262, which now adds about 15 executive appointments to a list that must be confirmed by the Oregon State Senate. So we do have that area that you're talking about, those who accept nominations for appointments that must be subject to review by the State Senate.
Well, see, I would say that that's ideal, that we get that information about the person before he actually
That's what I'm trying to get at. That's probably the most important place to have it, is the Senate Executive Appointments Committee to have that information in front of them when they're deliberating on whether or not they should recommend to the Senate that his appointment be confirmed. I think we can get there. It's just accepted nomination for appointment. It's really accepted the appointment, what he's getting at, I think, at the moment. So I think we can work that out.
Are there any more questions? One, we have a letter from the Oregon State employees, and they point out that this definition of who files a report, a public employee who received more than $600 a month, I see that that's for legislative employees, but then it does include all employees and of cities, and this means that according to this, there would be about 60,000 people who would have to file. That's quite a lot of.
That's under the old.
Under the old one?
Yeah.
Section 14 has been changed, and that's on page 5. attorney to submit a statement today, and I believe you may have an older statement.
Yeah, April 30th. I haven't seen anything. Is that dated when? This was dated April 30th.
Ralph, we're getting kind of skittery on the floor of the Senate. We have what we call the Lent rule, and that was brought about by then-Senator, now Judge Lent, who objected last session, starting off notwithstanding any other provision of law. We're uniformly defeating all bills that don't say what particular point of law we're talking about. I noticed the first one I saw was in Section 3, except it's provided by law. In that we're, as Senator Fahey said, we're trying to say not what is, but what ought to be, you know, state a matter of policy. It seems that that statement, except it's provided by law, almost speaks that we can statutorily provide for public officials to use their official position to make gains themselves.
Well, what that clause provides for is the person being able to accept his salary, which is a gain to himself. Or
don't you think we better say that? I mean, isn't that what you're...
That's what we're after, whatever your pleasure.
Well, I'm just thinking, I've had experience taking this out on a constitutional amendment or something to people, and they'll look at that and say, well, you mean that you fellows in the legislature can change the law and provide that you can use your official position to obtain financial gains yourself? And that's not what anybody intended, so I think we can just write in the salary provision.
Which page are you talking about?
Page 3. It's the new typewritten.
Oh.
They tried to open it up so we get our salary, but it's a rule.
Under that same section 14B, governors are not the only people who appoint committees and so forth. Would a committee appointed by a county commission have to declare their conflict of interest?
We get elected officials, and then we get the one layer immediately below them of those people elected or appointed by elected officials and serving at the pleasure of those elected officials.
Well, I can see the county court appointing a library board, and among the members they would like to appoint would be somebody who deals in the retail selling of books or in wholesaling of books. He might be a very valuable member of the library board, and sometimes they might want to buy one of the books he wants to sell or he has to sell. County committees appointed by counties are difficult at best. The same would be true of a city planning commission, and the member of the planning commissioner, a member of the planning commission might be an architect. Would this be a conflict of interest?
We don't prohibit anyone from serving on any board there or voting on any measure.
I appreciate that.
And all we are asking is that he make available the public information upon which they might judge a potential conflict of interest. So he would be required to file a statement.
Well, I hate to discourage local bodies from finding capable people to serve on their boards and commissions. It's difficult now. But whether it does or not, I don't
think.
Well, there is another aspect of this whole thing that I think helps to counterpoise that argument, which is a very legitimate argument, and that is, if we, through this legislation, lift the level of confidence and prestige of public officers, we'll find a much larger reservoir of talented people that are willing to take the office of politician.
The members of the Senate are much more familiar with Senate Bill 100 than I am. Is there anything in Senate Bill 100 relative to the appointment of people surveying land, or not so much that as trying to keep their own land zoned for agriculture, for instance, that would...
You mean of the membership? No. We have been a couple bills that
I was talking to senators on Senate Bill 100. Is there anything in the Senate Bill 100 that would be a problem?
boards, commissions, whatever?
Interestingly enough, there is a tendency in this legislature, more than I've ever seen it, to mandate seats on the boards, commissions, agencies, and so on, because of what we call expertise.
Mm-hmm.
I just heard it identified, I think, by you, as a potential conflict of interest. That is truly an architect, well, for instance. Most of the planning commissions, if the bill that comes out on the floor just has, it's mandated, will have, mandates somebody who's interested in real property, somebody who has economic or ecological interest, and so on. So oddly enough, the legislature is moving in one direction on getting expertise on commissions, boards, and so on. Same time that we're trying to...
Now, we have a half a dozen bills in environment that say that two people from environmental groups have to be on the smoke board and one on SB 100 and the different ones which mandate that, or at least the...
It's another thing, too, that we're going in another direction. We're going, as you know, on trade and commerce area. Okay. And we're trying to get all the people to make sure that there are several bills that are representatives of the public to get a cross-section of the public.
What would this do with the Bar Association and with the Medical Board? They definitely all have conflicts of interest.
Well, I think that the good place in the bill is not... The only time you get into trouble is if you assume expertise builds in a conflict. We have the same thing on the planning commission, where they're between interested in an economic or personal sense and interested in a, or disinterested. And I think we've got to take that as a value. If we try to find people that have no, we've heard the bill speaks to economic interest, but there's some good conversation earlier about personal interest, which is the other side we're not even addressing.
Well, let's take the bar for a minute, though. If you set minimum fees,
I wish you would, but
well, but in that minimal fees, wouldn't that be a direct personal interest?
Well,
or medical board setting minimal fees?
Certainly is. There's no question about it. And there's, you know, we've set it on for substitute teachers. We've set it on for the board, providing the state bar provides the minimum bar fee. Yeah, I think that there's no end of it. Medical examines, the doctors are asked to let people in or not in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can go right down the list, sir.
What's your opinion about teachers in the legislature voting on teacher salaries? You asked me. Yes,
I could withdraw because from the question because I happen to be a teacher myself. But,
I thought the new direction was that we weren't going to vote on state salaries anymore. We have now negotiation teams, and they come to us with the ways and means with the thing all finished. I
well, you still vote yes or no.
Whether we accept the negotiation?
Yeah, of course we do.
That's the way we're going to say
it. We get off the point here.
Yeah. Well, we used to determine what state employees would get. Now we're accepting.
Well, I don't like to make this into a work session, which is to some extent what we're doing. Are there questions that we should direct at these two people who are proposing the bill primarily?
I would like to introduce my colleague, Chuck Habernick, an attorney from Portland, who has worked with us all the way through. And any of the more technical questions of law, he would be better qualified to answer. I was here before he did on the public open meeting bill. Ralph is our real expert on conflict of interest, and I have some backup work I've done on it. I'd be glad to answer questions if you like. I might say I have some experience